Off the ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.
You ain't shit!
I wish I was 50 years younger and I'd kick your ass.
Well, fans can be the harshest critics, you know.
And they often are.
A wife is often the harshest critic of her husband.
I thought I was invincible. That's what you're trained to believe as a sports person.
There was 4 million people in Ireland who knew much more about managing football teams than I did. When it comes to music, I can spoof for the best.
Your sporting career is the best time you'll have, and you know you have to hang on to it for as long as your life, because everything else is pretty crappy.
And this is not light. Stephen Rothschild has never spoken to Jimmy McGuinness in his life.
I'll never, ever, ever get tired of that clip. It was amazing. Thank you for that one, David Brady. It is time for our Saturday panel, joined in studio by Kieran Cunningham, chief sports writer with the Irish Daily Star, Paul Rouse, lecturer in Irish history and sports history at UCD and author of several books as well along the way, including GA, People's History, and Turlough O'Brien, the Carlow football manager, and a scribe as well in his own right, author of Cycling South Leinster, Great Road Routes. You're very welcome to the show, each and every one of you. For today, we're talking about events inside GA venues, in Croke Park in particular, given the fact that you two are there this evening. And of course, it's not the first time that they've been there.
And with more than 50,000 tickets sold, the promoters are feeling fairly good humoured too. Supporting acts this afternoon were Antua Nua, The Alarm, Squeeze and REM. For U2, the Dublin band with 4 albums in the American charts, it's a hero's welcome home.
Mate.
Great.
Cool. Mad. Brilliant. Excellent. They deserve to be on Top of the Pops every night. I'm telling you, they're...
Well, they've done a lot for the Irish music scene anyway, that's for sure. They've brought a lot of respect back to the Irish music scene.
Whatever's happened, I hope that kid ended up as a music journalist, because they had a future, it's fairly safe to say. But you two in Croke Park, and 85 is when that clip was taken from, which was, I think, the first stadium gig to be held inside Croke Park, and they're pretty late to the dance, it turned out. First of all, we'll go around the table. Is anybody actually heading along tonight?
I am, yeah.
You are?
Yeah, I didn't
you say that rather sheepishly.
I didn't expect. I feel guilty, because I'm sure the people that were scrambling for tickets, and I just got a text, do you want to go? I've had a spare ticket, so I said, yeah, okay. So I just fell into my lap. But it was actually the second concert in Croke Park. Neil Diamond was the first in 84. 45,000 people turned up, apparently, and he played Forever in Blue Jeans 4 times because people kept calling for it.
So
U2 then the following year. I was at the U2 in 85 and 87. And actually, a great story about the 87 one, Colin Bonner, one of the 3 Bonner brothers of Tipperary, but he went along to that bill in 87 and he left after Squeeze. He only went to see Squeeze. He had no interest in staying for you too. So he's my hero.
I'm admiring that dedication, yeah, to be quite honest, to go along and just see the support band. I've been in that position a couple of times whereby you just kind of go, yeah, I'm just going to see the support act and get out of it. There are times I wish I did that. I think Kings of Leon and Teenage Fan Club in Lansdowne was one of those where, you know, Teenage Fan Club just stole the show and Kings of Leon were fairly dull.
Well, like the 85 one, there was a documentary made around that, and you see when Bono does come out, he says the Jacks are back and what an All-Ireland we have for you tonight, which is a quote from Micheál O'Hare, but it actually wasn't his line. Phil Lynott said the same at Daleman Park in 77 when Thin Lizzy went to the stage. He said the Jacks are back, so Bono was borrowing.
And it's, of course, Paul, we talk about events that aren't gigs being held, or that aren't GA events being held in Croke Park, and it's funny that Ciara mentioned both, because they initially were one of the tenants down there in Jones's Road and before its current incarnation.
Yeah, Bose played soccer there before the GA took it over. It was used for horse racing back in the 1890s as well, and after the GA bought it in 1912-13 and did it up, they needed to make money back, and during the 20s there were an extraordinary range of events there in the 1920s. For example, there was a fete there in 1922, which all Chero planes was like a kind of a modern Mosny or whatever, people coming in.
Funderland,
essentially. Well, it was Funderland comes to the north side, and then 2 years later was probably the best event ever in Croke Park was a rodeo.
How does a rodeo end up happening, not only in Croke Park but specifically in Ireland?
It's like one of the Tyrone Armagh games.
There was a less than complimentary text actually came in about Ulster football when we mentioned a rodeo in Croke Park that I wrote read out on air, but there we go. Rodeo in Croke Park, it's 24, was it?
Well, it was a huge thing in popular culture from the 1880s, 1890s onwards. These stories of the Wild West and everything coming back, and Buffalo Bill Cole Cody, and there were kind of comic books about it, and then cheap novels, and then of course by the 1920s there were films being made of the Wild West. So this rodeo, this travelling rodeo, arrived in Croke Park for 2 weeks, and there were cowboys the Indians in various fighting. There were cowboys going around lassoing calves, and it was kind of a great celebration of nationalist Ireland. There were huge cheers every time one of our Irish calves escaped from the ropes of American cowboys. But it was hugely frequented. Like, there were two shows a day, a matinee and an evening show, 20,000 people a show for 2 weeks. I mean, it made a huge amount of money.
Well, I'd imagine it was a case in point for people, I suppose, in terms of a concert. When people use, you know, famous pop figures as touchstones in their lives, they usually only get to see them on TV. And the same thing here with this rodeo. You would have ordinarily only seen people, I guess, on the big screen if you're lucky enough to go to the cinema. Or if you just couldn't afford it, you would have heard Fables. And to see an actual cowboy in the north side of Dublin on Jones's Road in action would have been just massive.
And there is a thing that happens in every society at every time where something just takes off and it becomes the thing to go to.
Ed Sheeran.
Are you going or two?
I'm still over tickets.
It's one of those things that it becomes a day out.
Yeah.
And it's not, you might not necessarily be going for the thing itself, but you're going because everybody else is going.
Mm. I hate to say this, but Croke Park must almost seem like a remote beast for the GAA aficionados in Carlow.
Yeah, well, it's probably been, you two have been there more often than Carlow, probably, in the last 30 years. Mm. Certainly, yeah, we wouldn't have had too many days up there, you know, but I do remember that 1985 concert was the first concert I was at. It was a great occasion, and I'm sure tonight's going to be epic too for whoever goes to it. But
what was the kind of sense of going to a gig in 85 in Croke Park? Because, like we mentioned, like stadium gigs, outdoor gigs in Ireland was a pretty new concept. Like Porky Cueve actually were in there beforehand, and we would have had stuff like McCroom, we would have stuff like Lissie Varna. But in terms of hosting it in a Dublin stadium, this is almost a rarity, and especially within kind of hallowed GAA ground, as it would have been by that stage.
Yeah, I don't remember from that point of view, but
you were just like, I'm going to see you too.
You too, yeah. and I just remember it was an unbelievable light show, and the sound was incredible. It was the first big outdoor concert I was at, and it was just one of those historic occasions, really, and Croke Park obviously added to that.
What was the crowd like back then? Because the one thing, and we'll get to the Porky Cueve stuff soon, but I remember seeing T.G. Carhart did a brilliant job of showing live, old live footage from different gigs around about Ireland. They showed stuff from the Gaiety, they showed Seamus Ó Coileachlí, and they showed one of them that sticks in the memory, and I don't know why I stuck around watching it for as long as I did, was Leo Sayer from 1984 in Porky Cueve. And the bloom was very much off the rose for Leo Sayer in terms of a solo performer in 1984. Like, I don't think he'd had a top 20 hit in about 3-4 years in the UK, I don't know about here. But the crowd were absolutely mental for him, from start to finish, like stuff that I'd never heard him do, and you can just look around and the crowd were leaping. It seemed that there was a gratitude for this size of event in Croke Park in Ireland, outdoors generally, that doesn't seem to be there anymore. There's a lot of folding your arms and proving it to me this time around.
Yeah, well, I suppose if, you know, it was early days outdoor concerts, and it was new and it was exciting, and it was something you saw on television from abroad, and here you had one of the best bands in the world playing in Croke Park, and thousands and thousands of people at it, and it was very, I suppose, in terms of security, it was low key, and you could move around, and it was just an epic occasion.
Yeah, but just on how low key security was, like the first gig I ever went to was you two as well. The Turlough was 2 years earlier in the Phoenix Park when I was 16 with Simple Minds of Big Country. And there was loads of forged tickets went around, and also a gang of skinheads crashed the entrance, and it was pretty chaotic. Which was par for the course a lot of times at gigs in Dublin at the time. But at one stage, a gang of skinheads were up near the front when Eurythmics came on and started chanting F off British pigs at Annie Lennox. And she started making a speech about peace and brotherly love or something. And eventually, a plastic bottle hit off the side of her head, and she gave up the speech and just called them effing idiots.
So much
and
for
Dave Stewart, the crowd applauded when she said that, and it seemed to calm it out of it.
So much for the script in Newsweek claiming that music hasn't been political forever.
Yeah, but I remember, just very quickly, but in 85 I remember this, going to a steward, and I'd arranged to meet somebody at the Hogan Stand. I said, "Where's the Hogan Stand?" And he said, "How can you not wear that? Have you never been to Croke Park before?" And I said, "Well, for Donegal, we never, we never went to Donegal. Like, Donegal never actually played at Croke Park the day the U2 concert in 83. I didn't go to that. So against Galway, I decided to go to the park instead." So.
I remember being quite, the first time I was in Croke Park for a gig was for the Police when they did that reunion tour. And I remember being quite, I don't know, it seemed like a big deal. I remember talking to my dad on the phone that I just walked out in the pitch of Croke Park, and it just seemed like, granted, it was for the police and it was for fill Sting's pockets for the next 20 years. But ultimately, it was still like, you know, this feeling of walking out there and looking around and seeing the stands actually on your, you know, 3-4 sides. You're like, oh, this is an amazing thing.
Do you like it as a venue?
I've been there twice as a venue, and I think it's okay. It's probably a little bit big, if I'm being honest. It's probably too big for that kind of thing, no matter how loud it is, no matter how huge the screen setups was. And I was there for Beyonce last year, and she made the most of that setting. But I don't know, it just seems like it's a bit... Things can drift the further back you go, both in terms of attention and in terms of the experience.
I think that's it. You know, you see those reports of the Coldplay concert and everyone said the sound was fantastic. I've been to a few concerts there and the sound, I thought the sound was pretty ropey, depending on where you were. And I wasn't at the 85 U2 concert. I wasn't an Echo. I was 21. I was 14. I wasn't an Echo. I was scarred ever since. But it was there in 1987. And the thing I remember most from 1987 is some fella dancing on top of the stand and just not coming down. And Bono trying to get him to come down, and he like... safely, and being stuck up there. That's probably what I remember most.
That happened a lot. Like, there was an amazing picture went around last week. I don't know if people remember the 1991 All Ireland final, and a guy went up on the stand, a Down fan, for the Down Meath final. Yeah. But it turns out it's Conor Harrison's father, Liam. That's who that fan
just
was.
Just decided to scale.
That's the current full forward. That was the fan.
There were a lot of people got up on top of those stands back in the 80s. Around that time, particularly for Dublin games.
Yeah. But if you look back at the old photo, like, you would have them in your books, Paul, of like Down Offaly and 61 or 7, people sitting on the stands, the roof of the stand. It was crazy.
Yeah.
It was absolutely crazy.
Paul, why was Croker so late to putting on actual concerts?
Well, I think that's a general question for how Irish society was working at the time as well. I mean, Ireland was late getting into the big music venues during that stage, and there's also resistance. There was a resistance in Croke Park to changing how it operates. It's always slower to change than other things. So you had Ballymount in, as you said before, and when did Slane was going mid-80s as well, wasn't
Slane was early. There was a clip earlier on today of Jagger there in 82, so
I think
been,
the first one was 81. Thin Lizzy and U2, and Thin Lizzy headlined, and I think U2 in 82 then would have been when it really kicked off. But like, that's like Frank Murphy, that's his legacy. Like, everybody gives up to Frank Murphy, but Seamus Akosh Lee paid for Park O'Keefe and started off with Oliver Barry. Like, Oliver Barry had the cop on to recognise this is, you know, rather than a big open air field, that a stadium would work better.
It's matching, and it matched what was happening around the world as well. So you had the use of stadia all across America from the late 70s onwards, and it's the way trends, we just follow trends.
See what's done elsewhere and do there. Did you ever make it down to the Seamus Akosh Lee sort of, or
no? That was it. Croke Park was
just looking up in one direction. There. But it is amazing that they twigged fairly early, because I think it was 76 when the Porky Queeve opened, and it was 77 by the time they had their first gig in there, and by 78-79 they were rolling. They were getting the international acts in then, because getting the international acts over for big gigs in Ireland wasn't necessarily an easy thing to do late '70s, early '80s. Because of the risks involved, I suppose, that they perceive anyway, that they thought Ireland is all being exploded and we can't go there. But it was ultimately all one corner up in Belfast.
But there are still pressures on it. Look at the what happened with Garth Brooks when he was due to come.
That's an interesting one, because that's the one where it seems like they overstretched themselves.
By their own admission,
they
made a mistake.
They saw euro signs ringing and went.
The cash till was going, and things gather momentum. And I suppose, in fairness, things gather momentum. But by their own admission, they just made a serious mistake.
I mean, it is interesting the way it's different this year, that they've been spaced out. Like, Coldplay was one night 2 weeks ago. Mm. Was it two nights?
It was the one night, I think.
One night 2 weeks ago. Then U2 is one night a fortnight later. Whereas before they would have had Friday, Saturday. I think U2 played Friday, Saturday, Monday at one stage.
Yeah.
And I think the residents, you know, that's one thing. The run of concerts together, they don't like that at all.
We do have, it's interesting to see how things have developed, especially in around Croker, and especially you mentioned in around the timings of those gigs. This from 87 was a report on the aftermath, I guess, of U2's gigs there, or a squeeze, as some might have seen it in that run. But it's the aftermath and the effect that it eventually had on the pitch.
Just over 2 weeks ago, thousands packed Croke Park to see U2. Today, the GAA decided to postpone Sunday's senior hurling final between Kilkenny and Offaly, and the reason was the state of the pitch. So could the future of rock concerts at Croke Park be in doubt? I asked the GAA's financial controller, Kieran O'Neill.
Maybe we were a little ambitious with the rerun of the concert, the double event. Maybe we were slightly over-ambitious, but this is the way things are. We're naturally disappointed that the pitch hasn't come back as quickly as we had hoped.
Does the GAA need the money from these concerts?
Very, very badly, because the GAA is, I suppose it's perceived as being a wealthy organisation. But the wealth, unfortunately, is confined to our assets, to our properties. Concerts have enabled us to do something about that, have reduced the burden of that. And that's a consideration on the one side. The consideration on the other side is the unfortunate situation in which we find ourselves at the minute, and that is with the cancellation of next Sunday's eagerly awaited Leinster Hurling Finals.
Always be selling the event, fair play. But it is interesting because it almost has echoes when we heard Jim Gavin last week talking about the state of the Croke Park pitch, and to look at it from on high or from the TV cameras, you wouldn't think that there's any necessarily difference to what was going on post Coldplay, but then they rip it up again towards the Hill 16 end, and the surface is relayed in terms of putting down this plastic kind of surface and so people can walk on it. Did you have any experiences of Croke Park pitches there, or other pitches that were torn up essentially all those events?
I can't have only what I've seen in the past, that when Croke Park was damaged, but they seem to have perfected it in recent years to have it pristine, really, for games. Now, obviously, there's a problem there at the moment, but you would wonder when you keep relaying, the new surfaces, that it can't be as stable or as have the same bounce of a ball, the feel for players,
it's the consistency as well.
And like there's four games next weekend, four big games, two All Ireland quarterfinals, two qualifiers. So, like by the time of the fourth game, what will the pitch be like? Like, because Jim Gavin and a few, I think Kieran Kilkenny talked about as well, they weren't happy with the pitch at all.
And I remember Dublin having similar complaints. It was 2009, if I remember correctly, against Kerry. There wasn't long relayed after that, and there was talks, and it was quite obvious the players were slipping.
Back when that Leinster hurling final was postponed, it was very very basic covering. Like, they didn't rip up the pitch or anything. They just did a kind of heavy plastic tarp on it or whatever. But now it seems more sophisticated, but it's a test of it next weekend. Like, four games and one weekend's a test anyway, and after it's been ripped up twice in a couple of weeks.
From the financial standpoint, what's the view from inside the GAA of the way that this money finds itself in its coffers and the trickle down, or is there any positive or negative thought on it?
Look, I suppose it's important to get the maximum use out of Croke Park, and there aren't that many games where it fills the capacity, so outside events like concerts are very, very important to the income stream for GAA, and how it trickles down to the grassroots is probably, a matter of debate for clubs around the country. They would feel they don't get it. Same time, Croke Park will justify that it is distributed through the coaching systems and so on, through county boards. And there's no doubt it is spread across the country. But clubs then, I suppose, are at the very bottom of the ladder, and when they want to get grants for development and so on, there's a certain amount of money there, but they probably would like to see a bigger pot of money being available at grassroots level. So I suppose the running cost then of the GAA is where the money's been spent.
It touches on something that you were speaking about with Ian O'Riordan in the Times, I think it was today's piece of them, in that you were talking about how it'd be better for counties if there was a grant or if there was some kind of financial reward from the GAA to bring everybody up to the same level in terms of strength and conditioning, that it would give everybody a base to compete from there on in.
Yeah, I suppose the point I was trying to make was that, in the lesser ranked counties, I suppose, you get a team maybe that comes every few years and everything looks rosy in the garden, and then maybe the manager is gone or the players are past their best, and you're waiting for a new crop to come through, and the systems kind of fall apart. The point I was trying to make was that it would be better if counties like Carlow could put in place structures where they would have you know, strength and conditioning expertise or nutrition expertise available across all their county teams on a consistent basis by employing professionals to do that, and that it's not reliant on a manager to come in with his team of people who may be just, you know, friends of his and may not be the best people to do the job, which has happened in the past, that they would be pals of the manager and, you know, the sports science would have been limited, you know, in the backroom team, you know. So I think with the amount of sports science graduates in the country now, that there is sufficient expertise out there to sustain, you know, the proper development of players from underage right up to inter-county level.
Is that what you saw this year, that Carlo was finally on that a level to compete that way, and that you'd spent the previous 2-3 years bringing the county and bringing the players, bringing the panel up to that level, and that now they were able to almost put their best foot forward?
Well, it was part of it, but to be fair, the systems have been put in place in Carlo before I got involved. There's a lot of really, really good work being done in Carlo. There's the Colts development squad system has been very, very good for the last 4 or 5 years now, and the county board have developed links with IT Carlo, which has proved very, very beneficial. The sports science end of Carlo IT is available to all county teams, and the county senior footballers in particular take a huge advantage of that, as have the Colts. And certainly it has helped our senior footballers in the last 3 years that we've had that access to the facilities, but more importantly the expertise. The head of the sports science department is Damon Sheehan, and he's one of our selectors. He's responsible for our sports science and conditioning, and he would use interns from the college then to gain experience for them and to assist in what he's doing. So we would have, I would say, as good a system in place as any other county.
They seem to be a slightly forward-thinking setup, though, in terms of the county board and Carlo. If they were forging those links with IT Carlo, and if they had the Centre of Excellence available to you as well, that they would have thought that, you know, listen, we're not going to do the county any service by getting a big-name manager in, hopefully boosting results for a year or two, and then watching things settle back to the way they have been for the last 15, 20 years. There's actually a thought of progress within the county.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a line of thought, I suppose, that is now being developed in all the counties, really. You know, I think Leinster, GAA in particular, are kind of advocating that approach by counties. We're fortunate the IT is based in Carlo, but anywhere that has an IT college or a university should be tapping in there, because the expertise is there. It's incredible expertise, and, you know, all these guys are getting employment in the other sports, and the GAA is the biggest sporting organisation in the country, so we should really be a source of I suppose employment for these people as well.
Is it a sense of pride, like, for a county like Carlo, because I know you've written extensively about them as well, Paul, in that they, you know, they want to bring things up to a certain level, they want to be able to compete at the level of others, and you saw this year it's the first time since the 40s that they won, I think, as many championship matches as they had done. Just to get to that level and to compete requires a little bit of looking outside and looking for as much help as you can possibly get, and that these things can possibly help.
I think what has happened in Carlo, or what is happening in Carlo, is hugely admirable, and it's actually a lesson for other counties. And what I think is really admirable about it is that it's football and hurling, unlike other counties which pay lip service to hurling or don't even really even pay lip service to it. In Carlo, there's a genuine commitment to develop in both games, and I think that's admirable, and particularly admirable in a county its size. And there is no hiding from the fact that for Carlo to go to the next level, even to get to Division 3, will be a huge struggle. From 3 to 2 then will be another massive struggle. There's no point in saying that, but to make that has to be the ambition for any county which is down the bottom. My own county, Offaly, could as easily be in Division 4 next year as in Division 3, and I think they're in the same battle of trying to maximise every single resource within the county to get there. And the great problem in Offaly is that the clubs of Offaly do not produce enough good players at the moment. And around that, then you have to have the support structures, the using at loan Institute of Technology for their sports science stuff, and moving it on like that. Now, as when it comes to resources and the use of stadia for resources, the simple fact is that the GAA builds grounds everywhere, and unless it held concerts into them, they wouldn't wipe their face in any shape or form. Look at what's happening with Parkyqueave.
Yeah.
Like, Parkyqueave is going to cost the guts of 80 million. 30 million comes from the public pocket. I find that extraordinary. But I think the GAA is absolutely right to develop Parkyqueave. The idea that Cork shouldn't have a high quality venue is totally wrong. But 30 million from state money for it. And where will Cork will now be competing? With Limerick, with Thurles and with Killarney for big games. Mm-hmm. So we'll be competing with ourselves.
Well, we're going to be facing a scenario. If you're to just look at, from the sheer optics of Semple Stadium, we're going to be in a position where I'd imagine we're having a conversation in 2, 3, 4, maybe even 5 years' time, where we're talking about the redevelopment of Semple, because as stadiums go, it's not exactly new. It doesn't exactly look, it doesn't look as well as, say, Croke Park or Pádraig Cúchulainn does now, or there are others as well, even smaller ones. But we're going to be talking about redeveloping that and then finding other ways to fund that as well.
But every stadium has a very limited shelf life. Even when you go to Croke Park now, you can see Croke Park is going to need stuff pretty soon. Like, you know, there's the story of the Colosseum in Rome. It looked great in its day, and it has its purposes now. But time doesn't stand still for any ground. You have to keep evolving the nature of the ground, and that costs money. But money is not going to come through the gates. The money is going to come through the events that are staged in the stadium.
But was there a term, a deal of short-termism? Like we mentioned about how Carlo are looking long-term in terms of their ways to not only fund themselves, but also, I suppose, to make the teams progress. But when you look at, I remember seeing the stories from a year or two ago whereby Croke Park only had the revenues it did because it had the All-Ireland replay in there between Cork. It was last year, actually. It would have had the extra revenues because of the replay between Dublin and Mayo. And if it didn't, then they were kind of looking around, scratching their heads and possibly thinking about putting on a 15th Ed Sheeran show in Croke Park this year just to wash their faces.
Yeah, and you hear people saying, oh, you know, we'll get concerts in and that'll help pay the bills. But if you look at the you're looking at somebody generally that will attract around 40,000 people at least, to make, if you want to make decent money out of it. So how many acts of that stature are touring every year? And you already have Croke Park looking for them, the Aviva looking for them, you know. So how many are going to be left for a Pádraig Cúchulainn or a Semple Stadium down the line? Like I think that's a workable model, that you think we can just get 2 or 3 massive concerts in every year.
They've almost done an admirable thing of decentralising over the past couple of years, whereby Springsteen was down in Nolan Park. And Ed Sheeran, part of his thing is going to be in Pearce Stadium as well. So they've gotten stuff out into the regions, as you've seen it.
Yeah, we've a unique form of democracy in the GAA, really. Like, we have 32 independent republics, and we tried then to get a national strategy then in terms of stadium development, and it's very difficult because everybody wants to have a stadium in their county, and that isn't feasible. And unfortunately, we are where we are now, and we have a lot of older stadiums that are, you know, dilapidated and not really fit for purpose in terms of, you know, big occasions. And instead of concentrating on 3-4 stadiums across the whole country, we have far too many, you know, 40,000 seaters that are never going to be filled unless we get more outside activities.
Yeah.
And Paul, your rodeo might be a great idea. My brother was just back from Canada, he was at a rodeo, and he thought it was great fun.
But I know at the Ulster final last week, they made a video presentation.
I hate the way we keep going straight from rodeo to Ulster football. that's at least 3 times in my head ever.
That's what I admire.
It's the connection. That's the connection you have in your head for some reason. But anyway,
Stephen Poacher's a cowboy.
But they made a presentation, a video presentation, the new Casement Park will look like if and when it happens. But I like the look of it. It looks like one of the mid-tier Bundesliga grounds. And I think something that's feeding into it now is the people who go to GAA games generally are travelled now and have been to games abroad in soccer, rugby, and they might have been to the Euros in Poland or France, or gone to games with Munster or whatever, or even going back to the World Cup in Japan, and they've seen very modern, high-tech, up-to-date stadiums. And the generally GAA grounds look very dated now. Like Pádraig Cúchulainn is a massive improvement of what it was, but to me the design looks dated. There doesn't seem much cover. It looks very much like a traditional GAA ground.
It looks like a modern version of what it was.
Yeah.
It looks like they've dickied it up a little bit in terms of what it was. They've added on an extra covering, etc. But
it's, look, we're a very small country, and we're very small base for attendance at sports events. Like, and you know, I mean, Croke Park isn't filled capacity maybe 3-4 times a year, and now we build another one in Belfast. What's going to do to Clonus?
Yeah,
I'd often bypass Croke Park to go to Clonus. I love the atmosphere. I love the atmosphere in the town. I love the atmosphere in the stadium itself.
And that's as important as anything.
I think we saw that this year in Dr. Cullen Park when Monaghan were down. The atmosphere was electric.
The Bertie Bowl would have been disaster because it would have been out in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. There was no shops or no restaurant, no bars around. There'd be no life. You'd have gone in and out, parking. You know, that was it. There would be no life, no buzz.
No,
like maybe inside it would have been grand, but outside, and it's about the outside experience as much as anything.
Absolutely, but you know, the stadium were fine, but at the end of the day, you need to have something to promote. And, you know, the Dubs coming out of Croke Park, lads, is a massive, massive promotional tool for the GAA. And, you know, not to allow them to play Laois and Portlaoise last year, not to allow them to come to Carlow this year, I think was a big own goal by the GAA. I think we lost out on a massive opportunity to promote the game in both those towns, both those counties. Mm. And, you know, whether it's Clonus or it's Carlow or Thurles, you know, we can fill it when the Dubs come. But we don't see Seaton coming to us because of season ticket holders, and I think that's a spurious reason.
Is that the worry for you now as well? Because what we're looking at and what we're facing into next year, you were talking about it as well with Ian in the Times, is that we're looking at the Super 8 format, and essentially the quarterfinals are going to be weeding out, as you would see it, the smaller teams. There won't be a chance for the likes of a Tipperary or a Carlow or whatever to progress to possibly the level of an All-Ireland semi-final, because it's almost like the theory of referenda in this country, whereby you'll take the referenda until you get the right answer. And this quarter-final setup that we're going to have now at the Super 8s is designed and geared to benefit the larger teams.
Well, I think it's designed really to provide, I suppose, more top-class games, I suppose, really is what they would say. But you take Tipperary, you take Clare, who've made great breakthroughs in the last few years. Like, you know, on a one-off occasion, they could cause an upset in a quarter-final. But to ask them to play three weekends in a row with, you know, a limited panel of players, players will get injured, players will get suspended, players will have a collection of black and yellow and red cards and be ruled out for something that happened 6 months ago. And these are huge penalties for these counties when they come then to play on the second or third Sunday in a row. And they wouldn't have the strength and depth of Dublin or Kerry or Tyrone or Mayo. And we're going to just see the top four teams really coming through all the time. I think it's a mistake.
How would Carlow have fared this year if you'd have made it through to a notional Super 8 tournament?
We would have had a great day out the first day, I would say, but we couldn't sustain it, I'd imagine. You know, the playing the following weekend is a huge ask. You can see that already. Any team that plays a provincial final and plays a qualifier the following week is under serious pressure. We played Leitrim, and we played the following week against Monaghan, and the bodies were still tired, you know, still tired.
But it's because Turla mentioned it there, the strength and depth. That's the massive difference. You're involved in club here, Paul, and you look like, you see somebody like Gavin Burke in St Vincent's, who isn't, I don't think he's even at the Dublin panel at the moment. He was on the fringes for a few years, and most counties would be one of your best forwards. And he's not even getting near the Dublin panel now. So, you know, it's so hard to compete that. The amount of the games you watch at Dublin, you think it might be tight enough for 50, 55 minutes. But then you know they're going to bring on six subs. And they always use six subs every day. And those six subs are always going to be really good players. And that makes the difference. Most managers are looking, you might have two or three that you think can do a job. And the other three, you're hoping something might come off them.
But they seem almost determined to remove that X factor from games. When we talk about what it would have meant to have Dublin down, now watch Cullen Park this year, you know, obviously you got them out of Croke Park, which is one thing. But it's that question mark that adds to a game can almost be lost if you just end up having these, because let's be honest, a lot of these games are going to be played in Croke Park ultimately, I would imagine, in Super 8, or if it's, you know, south facing, that they'll probably be in Porkycueve. So you're going to lose that little X factor of having a game in Walsh Park, having a game in Netwatch Cullen Park, having a game in Moore Park.
Well, I think the plan is that there's one home, one away, and one neutral. Is the way they will work. And I have no doubt that there will be an increase in quality games between top quality teams in July and August, and it will fix that idea of making the end part of the championship more competitive and providing more games. I think the great disappointment for me is the entire lack of vision displayed by the people who run the GAA in coming at this as an answer to the various problems that are around the place. There is nothing being done for counties who are going to, will say, fall in the bottom 16, who have no realistic chance of progressing through that scenario. It is going to create havoc within clubs, particularly now that the new move is to create hurling games at an earlier part of the season. So I look at my own club, Tullamore, in Offaly, a dual club. We won't have the people who play hurling from May and June. We won't have the people who play football if Offaly were to progress later on. There will not be a serious club match played in Offaly basically from April to August if Offaly make any sort of progress in football. And where is the answer coming from the people who run the GAA to that particular problem.
Because this thing we hear is that it's going to be a 3-year trial basis, but 3-year trial basis in the GAA means unless it goes horrifically wrong, we're keeping this afterwards.
And what will happen within that 3-year trial basis is an answer to what Turlock has pointed out there, and that is that there will be everyone will say, ah, player welfare, we can't play every week. And it'll then go to 2 games and, you know, it'll be every fortnight or it'll be every 3 weeks. It'll be two games in 4 weeks. So that kind of 3 games in 4 weeks. So it'll be spread and slowly spread and it'll colonise the rest of the summer.
Mm. Will the spreading of it aid your cause if we were to get there, or there's just no...
No, I don't see the upside to this at all. I think, you know, we can chase more big games all we want, like, but how many is enough, you know?
Yeah.
My take is that we need to actually roll back a little bit. I think we're just racing towards elitism. On one side, on the other side, we're saying we want to help the bottom 16 teams. Mm. You can't do the two. I think by increasing the games at the top level, I think personally, I think, you know, the one-off championship game might be the way to go back to. That might sound extreme, but the best competition we have is the National Football League, and it's played the wrong time of the year. Why not play the National Football League in the summer months alongside the championship?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people, even within the media, don't understand the frustration with the obsession with the elite. Like, even if you go back to the football championship previews, I would say 80%, 90% of what was written was about Dublin and Kerry, as if that's all that mattered. And everybody else is there just to make up the numbers. And like you see what Thurlow's done with Carlow. And people in September might say, that doesn't matter. Like, who cares? Like, you know, big deal. But it meant a massive amount to Carlow. It meant a massive amount to Monaghan when they won their Ulster titles in recent years. Counties like that made the breakthrough. Roscommon. Roscommon might be beaten next weekend, but that doesn't mean they can't come out this summer and saying that was special.
But you see the will there is for these counties to progress. Like, I remember even during the course of the Waterford-Cork match in the Munster Championship, the will that there was for Waterford to actually get this done, not from an anti-Cork bias, but the fact that it adds a bit of colour. The fact that a team that isn't Dublin, Kerry, Tyrone, Donegal, etc., or Mayo, is, you know, causing a story, making themselves known. That's what actually makes these things brilliant and makes these summers. And without wanting to blow smoke up your ass, because you're sitting to my left, Carlow have been brilliant this year. They've invigorated the championship, essentially, and sides like that do invigorate championships rather than this procession and waiting for August to come around before things get decided.
No, it's a great point, Kieran. It's a great point. And I have always felt that this obsession with, you know, Dublin in particular, who are one of the best teams of all time, make no mistake about it, an incredible talent. But I think the whole approach by the GAA in terms of how it's promoting the game and marketing the game is wrong, and that the concentration on Dublin and Kerry is not doing anything for promoting the game across the country. You know, Jim Larkin, I think, said the great appear great because we're on our knees. But that applies to us in the GAA as well. Like, the great appear great because we're not getting a mention. We're not in the story. And I think that there are fantastic stories in every county across the country that are not being covered. And I think there's a great opportunity for the national newspapers to get in on this. And Carlow had a great year. We've had great stories. We've actually embraced the whole media end of it because we wanted to promote the game. But that could happen in any county in Ireland. And I just think this concentration on press nights where journalists have only access to 2 or 3 players is wrong as well. I think it's not doing anything to promote the game. I pick up the newspapers. I buy a lot of newspapers. I pick up the day after the press nights and I'm reading the same story in all the papers. That's no promotion.
But it's a business. Because you see now, like, how many events happen around the place now that are somebody selling a sliced pan or a new, they're endorsing the milk or whatever one you choose. And that's where you get your interview and some player stands up and says the most anodyne, pointless stuff and it makes the papers for a couple of weeks or a couple of hours and then it's gone. Yeah. It just disappears
Well, I think they really should respond to that by going for stories elsewhere, you know, because I think you will get them. I think if we're interested in promoting the game, certainly from a Carlow point of view, we have had so little coverage in my lifetime in national newspapers that we said we were going to brace this year and we would take any opportunity we got to talk about Carlow and talk it up as best we could.
I mean, you flew up to the Sunday game pretty much, you know, as soon as you had an opportunity to be up there.
Yeah, I did. I don't particularly like to be in the media, but I think it's important that we promote Carlow, you know. Yeah. And I often said at home, I'd say, you know, if there was a National League of journalists, then I'll be in Division 4. Sorry.
Be careful of your audience, Turlough.
I'm being flippant, but, you know, there are some really good journalists out there. But I think Everybody just
stick to your guns.
It's a race. It's a race for gold.
Just a quick one, Richard. Because you go just on the point that Paul brought up. You find now that whoever wins the All Ireland in September, then if it's Dublin, it'll Kerry in football, Clare, Wexford, whoever in hurling. You'll find that all these launches will go on all winter and all spring. And nearly every one of them, there will be play from each of those counties. And people will be sick. There's no games. There's nothing going on. There's none to talk about them. And it's just utter waffle. And because of the obsession with the winners. Like, sponsors come in now and think, we have to have somebody from the champions. Like, you go back. Paul might like this because he's an Offaly man and ended up as All-Ireland winners. But if I think of 98 and hurling, I think of Clare before Offaly. Because Clare dominated that summer with incredible stories and characters and personalities. And Offaly were brilliant for that as well. But it's not always about the winners. Like, even football that year, I remember Kildare that year as much as Galway, even though Kildare fell short because they'd beaten the three previous All-Ireland champions and it consumed the whole county. It's just everybody got behind them.
Yeah, I think, you know, the GA in particular is so community-based. Like, it's really about the characters and about personalities. You know, it's not about winning all the time. Yeah. And I think people love to hear these human stories of people like Sean Murphy, you know, who sheared sheep the morning we played Dublin. And these stories are all over the country, but we're not hearing them. And I think we need to, you know, maybe the journalists maybe need to be a little bit more adventurous and say, look, we're going to cover Leitrim, Longford, talk to people on the ground. Because I think a lot of the time, the national media's coverage of the lower-end counties is really related to maybe the results of their National Football League games. Yeah. Three or four names they might have picked out as top scorers or whatever. And that's the extent of their knowledge. Mm. I think a little bit more research might help.
But everything in terms of media, in terms of number of clicks on a website, in terms of number of copies of a newspaper bought, in terms of JNL hours for a radio station, is based around numbers and the amount of people, and maximising the amount of people in there. And I'm speaking from experience, and I can speak from a music experience as well. The fear is, if you're working in music radio, is that if you play a song that nobody knows, the people will turn off. Hmm. So if you go and have an interview with such and such a midfielder or such and such a forward from Longford, that people won't bother reading it, that they'll rather read what Aidan O'Shea has possibly done or not done with a selfie stick in the past, you know, 6 months, than reading how somebody or how football is progressing in Roscommon, etc. It's ultimately, you have to play to the audience.
Sure. It's funny, I had a debate online with somebody last week about this, that often people do have this obsession, because like, I was talking about like why the likes of, like, Joe Ward won three European championships at boxing at 23 years of age. He's an Olympic or world silver and world bronze as well. What he's done at 23 is extraordinary. He came back home and there was nobody there. There was no fuss made over him. And part of the argument there is that media outlets are stretched for resources. I accept that. But there's another argument that people make, that people aren't really interested in minority sports as well. But I found, and even looking at the analytics, because online it breaks it down, what people read. If a story is good enough, people read it. It doesn't have to be a massive name or a massive sport. If there's a really interesting story, you will get you will get people involved and engaged.
Keep your text coming in, 53106 for your texts, and you can tweet us at Off the Ball. The Dubs came to Clonus, as one texter, for a backdoor game against Derry a few years ago, and it was fantastic. People made a real night of it, and some of the fans were even sleeping on the diamonds the next morning, says Vincent in Clonus. I'm not sure we want to be encouraging that kind of thing. Also, David Mead saying O'Connor Park in Tullamore, the great little stadium, Borden Mona, O'Connor Park, we have to call it now, of course. It would be perfect for gigs, but transport and accommodation infrastructure probably not there. Best little stadium in the country for me, says David Mead. There's a shake of the head across me from Mr. House.
The train goes through Tullamore. A motorway goes 10 kilometres. It is the Field of Dreams, the finest stadium in the country, no question.
Who says this show is free of bias?
Can I just say, I once went to a game in Tullamore and I bought two sofas beforehand, so it was a great time to kill, isn't it?
Just
trying
for somewhere to sit.
Trying to get them home.
Are you saying just the seating?
Yeah, I was just going to say the stand's that bad. RGA and News Talk with Borgosh Energy giving customers exclusive access to GA Hurling All-Ireland Senior Championship at bgerewards.ie. More from the panel after this.
Off the Ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.
We've had one text in to 53106, and you're very welcome back to the show. Aidan O'Mahony on Michael Murphy in 2014 was the last rodeo in Croke Park, says that anonymous texter. We did start off this conversation by talking about events from outside of the world of GAA being staged in GAA stadiums, but we did see something of a circus emanate from what happened in Portlaoise earlier on the year, Turlough, and you would have had a bird's eye view for the Dermot Connolly incident and would have gone along there. Were you surprised at the time at what emanated essentially from all that, and that it became so big? And what was your view on it at the time?
My view at the time was it was a Dublin nine ball. first of all, and the linesman flagged it for Carlow. Dermot Connolly didn't realise he had flagged it for Carlow. He'd gone to retrieve the ball. Our guy saw the linesman flag our way, so they went to get the ball from Dermot, and ended up in a bit of a wrestling match, and it just kind of just escalated a little bit. And look, he had a few words with the linesman, and he did put his hand on him, but the disciplinary rules are really need of an overhaul. The suspension is too extreme for what happened. I had a lot of sympathy for him, to be quite honest with you. Certainly he needed to be reprimanded some way, but 12-week suspension, lads, for that is just outrageous.
Yeah, things can be fairly black and white in terms of how they lay them out, and they're not representative of the actual incident per se.
I think that's a bit of an issue too. I think my take on a lot of this is that when referees send players off for an incident, they often write the report by looking at the rule book first instead of describing what happened. And I think as a result then you end up, maybe there can be two categories of an offence.
Just in terms of how the language used is used to describe it.
Yeah, you can end up being charged with the more serious offence. And once he does that, that's your cast, your suspension cast in stone. You can't deviate from it. And I just think the need to overhaul all of that. And in fact, I go as far as to say that we'd be far better off to have three or four sighting commissioners who could look at an incident after a game and make a ruling on it, and that's it.
Kind of a Monday morning panel.
And do away with all these appeals. Yeah.
Well, like you saw Farsica's situation this week where Kildare appealed to Kevin Feely back hard. And I think it was the second one they picked up of three, but they couldn't appeal it until he'd had three black cards. So we're appealing a card from 4 months ago. Like, that's the joke. That's an absolute joke.
I think what Tara said there, I think that's an absolutely right about Kevin Feely. But the point about McConnelly is very well made. The what he did was wrong, and he shouldn't have done it. Obviously, but a 12-week suspension. In the context in which it happened and how it arrived into the referee's report without having been dealt with at the time doesn't seem to me to make sense afterwards. And I do think that Pat Spillane went after it with a relish on the Sunday game that was a little bit hard to take. And it was totally disproportionate to what happened.
But is that not... I think a couple of years ago that would have been a bit more relevant, Paul, in the impact of the Sunday game, but I think social media has changed that.
I think a lot of people had seen that incident because that was a Saturday evening game.
All day Sunday, people were quoting the rule and putting around the video clip. So I think the Sunday game had to respond to it, whereas before it would have had more power because people wouldn't be the same discussion.
I don't make that argument at all. I only make the argument of the particular tone with which Pat Spillane went after it. I thought it was way over the top.
I think the bullet points essentially maybe what he wanted to say laid out, and Pat being Pat kind of might have laid it on a bit thick in terms of how he presented his case, because that's the way Pat not only is a presenter but also a pundit.
Pat Spillane did at all.
I think it's straightforward. Maybe if you go on the tone of his voice, possibly. I never thought at the time, but as a transcript, I thought he read it straight.
I think he's entitled to express his opinion on what he saw.
I'm not arguing that. No,
but I think that. Fair as the GA, I don't think they're responding to what the Sunday game says. I think they're dealing with what comes up in the referee's report. And in this case, you would wonder how it got into the referee's report if it was deemed dealt with by the linesman at the time. How did it get into the referee's report afterwards? I suppose the referees and linesmen and fourth officials have a very difficult job, lads. I can tell you, being on the sideline, particularly in these big games, now we wouldn't have much experience for, but the day of the Dublin game, there's a big crowds and there's a lot of razzmatazz around the thing, and there's a lot of pressure on them. Yeah. And, you know, the lines are running up and down past you, and we're not happy with the decision. We're saying to the linesman, and, you know, there's going to be a kickback maybe at some stage. And I find that the best officials are the ones that actually talk back to you and you have a relationship with, and the ones that are very dictatorial towards you just get your back up and just makes it worse.
It's funny, every player and manager says that. It's the ones that talk to you. They're the ones of respect for.
Yeah.
But the guys that basically, like the schoolmaster approach, you know, you don't talk
to me.
That's right,
it's very hard to accept that.
Yeah.
Because you have no influence on what's happening, and you can't understand what's happened, and you just would like to hear He said whatever he did. That's what he saw. But you don't know what happened. It's very frustrating.
It doesn't help the perception of the GA as a whole when you see, cases being carried out like this and draconian punishments being handed down and the language used being fairly black and white. And I suppose it comes down to people's first experiences of the game. Like, that could be somebody's first, you know, sense of Dublin GA, or could be somebody's first sense of GA as a whole. Similarly to walking out in the pitch, as you mentioned earlier on, for a police gig might be the first encounter you have with the GA venue. Like, it all comes down to first impressions, and sometimes it can be the case where they don't necessarily help themselves. So,
But can you imagine what it's like to be a referee in a championship match? When you know you've the player, the fitness and conditioning of players is unbelievable. They cover the whole ground. 28 outfield players covering the whole ground. You have to keep track of timekeeping. In a split second, decide if someone has a black, yellow, or red card. You have water boys coming on and off who often do a lot more than carrying water bottles and get involved. And so, and there's all sorts of things going on and off the ball all the time. And in the blink of an eye, the ball can be switched 60 yards and you're supposed to keep up with the play. Like, I actually don't know how they do it without cracking up, or how anybody does it for an extended period of time, because they must come off that. I wouldn't say you could sleep for two nights after a game, and probably not the night before a game either. It's so much to be going through your head.
I'd have a lot more sympathy for referees now than I would have had in the past. Particularly last year or so, the pace of the game, particularly this year in the games as Division 1 teams, is just phenomenal. And to stay with that play, or stay up with the play and keep an eye on what's happening and things happen off the ball, and it's very, very difficult. But we haven't helped them know with the imposition of this black card. It really has been a very difficult for them, and I think we need to keep it much simpler. The yellow card can be used for these things, and pick up your second yellow, you're gone. But the black card,
and
is
even
a
like you saw the advantage calls last week. You know, they have to make a decision on that as well, which is very difficult to do. And like, it's easy to say when we've got replays, and why didn't you do this? Why didn't you that? Yeah. But I wouldn't like to be a referee. I wouldn't do it for any money. To be honest.
No. They're deserving a lot of respect, and the fitness levels of referees is really, really good too, and people compare it with rugby and say, look, there's no respect in GA for referees. It's a different game, you know. Referees in rugby, it's a stop start game, and you can talk to the referee and he can respond back to you. In Gaelic football, the referee can't catch his breath. You know, it's so fast and it's so intense, so it's a different game. But I think I'd have a lot of sympathy for them, but we have to do something that's about the number of things they're being asked to control in the game. It's just not on.
Has it always been? Is this the most stringent kind of examination of GAs and officialdom we've seen in the past while, Paul?
I don't think it's ever been any different. The referee has.
Has it always been okay?
There's a brilliant thing happened in the very first All Ireland Championship. Tipperary were playing Limerick in the All Ireland quarter final. It was Templemore were the champions of Tipperary and Commercials were the champions of Limerick, and they were playing out in Nina, and there was a few minutes left, and a goal was worth more than any number of points, and Templemore were just a couple of points ahead. Limerick completely split the defence, and they're about to score the winning goal. Can't miss. Forward about to pull the trigger when he's kind of met with a WWE style tackle and thrown to the ground, right? Sean and Campbell ends up in an absolute heap on the floor. What makes it all the more startling is that the person who perpetrated the tackle was actually an umpire, who was a member of the club who was officiating on the game. And this has been there. These controversies have been there right from the beginning. They've always been there, and they're never, ever going to be any different.
But I remember growing up, and the two of you probably, you would remember games, club games in the 80s as well. They were like faction fights. Yeah. Like, they were lawless. They were really... Like, people give out of it various offences now. The game is so clean compared to what it was. It was savage, particularly local derbies between rival parishes or something else.
There were seriously dangerous places like it. There's no doubt about that. It was. It's cleaned up an awful lot, lads. The game is played in a very good spirit now by and large, and it should be an easier game to referee, but it's more complicated because of the rules.
Yeah, there's several layers to things. Before we go, your last experience, because we started with first, I suppose, your last experience of a big gig or otherwise in a GA venue, when were you last in Croker for one of these things?
1985.
Was it 85 your last one as well?
Absolutely, yeah.
Give Turler a ticket. He deserves it.
If anybody wants to fire away, because we had somebody on to me earlier on, like I was saying that I couldn't, because Michael Jackson, I think, was the first thing down, or not first, but he played gigs in Porky Cueve in 88. And we had Dez on to us saying, I was at that Michael Jackson concert in Cork. Bear in mind, I'm only 31. Trying to work out.
What year was it?
88. So
22, it was two.
There you go. Two. Des. I'm not sure you remember most. Your last one, Paul.
Well, I was at U2 in 87, but probably the Failas and Thurles would be the ones I'd have.
Were they as mental as everybody kind of makes
it? Oh, they were absolute and utterly, it was annihilation.
Because we were trying to, we were saying this outside, Owen's only about 12 out in the box out there. I think Pete's not much older as well. I would have been way too young to go as them myself.
Yeah, they were absolutely epic. It was, I was at most of them. Fairly enough hazy around the time. The flag and Bulmers for breakfast is never really recommended.
Wouldn't recommend that, kids. Please drink alcohol responsibly and all that kind of thing. But like, was the whole thing of people sleeping and pitching up in people's front gardens?
The first one we went to, myself and my brother John went down. We went into Tullamore on a Saturday morning and we ended up in Thurles. We got the bus, we saw the bus, and we went down and we slept in the stand in the race course in Thurles. We've improved a lot since then.
Legally or... There was
no, everyone was around it. There was okay. There was a fair lot going on.
There was enough doing it that it seemed like it was okay.
Seemed fine.
Yeah, there wasn't going to be.
But Thurles was really like it was the whole place, because it was a small town. The whole place was taken over for the weekend. Like, there were people offered. There were, you had to pay to get a shower in people's houses, or you could buy sandwiches from their front desk. Like, it wasn't really like a modern festival. It was kind of wild.
Yeah.
Did you make any to the trip to tip here?
I didn't actually. I was in London a lot of the early 90s, and also there was that period, the kind of Manchester grunge thing that I never really got into. From Manchester to grunge, I never got into that for some reason. And the Failas seemed largely around a lot of those kind of bands. So.
But the thing about, and it's a very Irish thing to look back at it now, and we talk about the lineups that we had for, I think it was 85 when Intuanua and REM and U2 and stuff played Croke Park. When you look at the Faila lineups, there's an egalitarianism that's a very Irish thing that has been completely lost from festival lineups in that, and the Sheems of Cus Leisure are the same.
Yeah,
I mean, they'd be headlined by the Wolftones, but you'd have some kind of rock band like Mama's Boys,
the Saw Doctors.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's actually it's worth, you'll get it online. There's a poster of the Castle Bar Music Festival. I think it was 1979, but Madness headlined. I think Boomtown Rats were on as well. But it's brilliant. There's a brilliant line in small print near the bottom of the poster: "Mass available on site." Like, imagine they're offering mass at a festival.
In fairness, I was once at what was deemed a black mass at Electric Picnic one year, as performed by the much lamented and lost Warlords of Pez, who decided to conduct a black mass on one of the stages. I think it was midday on the Sunday. And I'm not a religious person by any means, but I've never been in more fear of the sky slicing open and a hand reaching down and smiting everybody in sight as I was at that particular moment. It seemed particularly odd. But when you look at, I've just opened up randomly, the 93 Faila lineup. If you were at the, and there was only the one stage, because granted you're only inside Semple Stadium, you would have had headliner Chris de Burgh, before him Madness, before them Mary Black, before them again Bjorn again and Christy Hennessy, and then makers of
the
hit Sweat by Inner Circle had landed them on the main stage as well. So you had Squeeze and Sultans of Ping, Aztec Camera, and the Indigo Girls. So talk about the maddest of lineups. That was, and then people going to sleep in front gardens and paying for showers, or in your case, Paul, sleeping in the stands of
I've improved dramatically since then.
He's moved on to the back gardens of Garda stations. It's been quite the progress for Paul Rouse. I want to thank you all for coming in this Saturday afternoon. It's been quite a conversation. We moved on from talking about going to Faila to going to different games and Jeremy Connolly's cards and all that kind of thing, but there we go. Such is the nature of Saturday panels. If anybody wants to make a last appeal for you two tickets, they're more than welcome to take the floor.
I'll take the pain. No, it's fine.
Are you sure? There's the sadness in your eyes that says you're not able to miss
Don't
out on that
me.
One tonight. Since this conversation has started, I have gone, I might add, from going to tonight's gig to not going. So there is that to bear in mind as well. So Kieran, you enjoy that if you can.
I will actually, just a very quick one. I meant to mention it earlier, a GA connection to rock and roll, but somebody pointed out this out to me that when Boomtown Rats went to number one with Rat Trap in 1977, it was 78, I think. But Dublin had won the previous two All-Irelands. On Top of the Pops, the drummer Simon Crowe had an Up the Dubs headband. There's a photo going around of it. You get the clip on YouTube. I'd never heard that before. Somebody pointed out. So.
And people only thought that tearing up a picture of John Travolta was heresy back then. But there you go. Thank you all so much for the afternoon. Our GAA News Talk brought to you at Borgosh Energy, official electricity partner to the GAA. You can follow the hashtag Hurling to the Core for all the senior championship action. For the first time since it got dolled up, we're off to Porky Queeve to talk to James O'Connor next.
Off the Ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.